listening to a podcast of a program produced in 2012 as part of Aloud, a series of dynamic conversations, readings, and performances that take place in the Mark Taper Auditorium at the historic Downtown Central Library in the heart of Los Angeles. These programs are presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles, which supports the Los Angeles Public Library. To support Aloud or learn about the entire podcast collection, please go to our website, www.aloudla.org. Dwight Eisenhower was actually the first president, not the first president when I was born, but the first president to enter my consciousness. I remember our mock vote at our kindergarten in Culver City, California. And I remember the first time, or actually the only time I was sent to the principal's office, the fact that it was a photo of Ike staring down at me from the wall. He was the general during the war. My father fought in the Pacific. You had to like Ike. He was often portrayed in the media, though, as indecisive, limited by his military upbringing. To one of his critics, he was, quote, babysitter-in-chief. And we've come to think of him, I think, over subsequent generations as gracious, gentle, perhaps ineffective. But there is way more to Dwight D. Eisenhower than most of us thought. Veteran journalist and editor-at-large of the Los Angeles Times, Jim Newton offers a bold reappraisal of the 34th president. His book, Eisenhower, The White House Years, yields a portrait of a shrewd leader, a progressive politician who grounded McCarthyism, built an interstate system, and turned an $8 billion deficit into a $500 million surplus, which is pretty good news, sounds pretty good to me now. As Newton's so importantly underscores in this very impressive book, Eisenhower was the first American president to have atomic weapons and not use them. Jim Newton is a veteran journalist who began his career as clerk to James Reston at the New York Times. Since then, he has worked as a reporter at the Atlanta Constitution and as a reporter, bureau chief, and editor at the Los Angeles Times, where he's presently editor-at-large. He's a native of California and has spent much of his life writing about the state, especially its politics, government, and legal affairs. He's written literally thousands of newspaper and magazine stories and is the recipient of many awards. He contributed to the Times reporting on the 1992 riots and the 1994 earthquake, both of which earned Pulitzer Prizes for the staff. Jim is also an educator, a very generous colleague, and the author of an acclaimed biography of Chief Justice Earl Warren, Justice for All, Earl Warren and the Nation He Made. And we are exceptionally lucky here in Los Angeles to be able to read Jim's regular weekly column on the Los Angeles Times opinion page. And we have the perfect interlocutor for Jim tonight, a renowned biographer. A. Scott Berg has written four best-selling biographies, each chronicling a prominent 20th century American cultural figure. Max Perkins, editor of Genius, won the National Book Award. Goldwyn, a biography, received a Guggenheim Fellowship. And Lindbergh was awarded the Pulitzer Prize. And Kate Remembered, which I'm sure many of you read about his longtime friend Katharine Hepburn, was a number one New York Times bestseller. He's currently writing a biography of Woodrow Wilson, and we are so pleased to welcome both Jim Newton and A. Scott Berg to the Los Angeles Library. Please welcome me. Join me in welcoming them. Thank you.
Thank you, Liz.
You're sweet.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you for the nice introductions. Thank you all for being here tonight. And Jim, thank you for writing this wonderful book. I just wanted to emphasize two things in the introduction that we just heard about Jim. One is you heard mention of his biography of Earl Warren. It's an absolutely spectacular book. So if you have time when you finish the Eisenhower book, or before the Eisenhower book, they really cross-pollinate. So I heartily recommend that book. Really one of the finest books I've read in years, many years. The second thing that I think is worth emphasizing, and this is sort of where I wanted to begin our discussion, Jim, is you have a day job. a rather big day job. And I'm wondering, what is it like? You're one day, you're showing up at the office, you're working at the Times, and then the next day it's, I'm now going to write a biography of Dwight Eisenhower. So how does this happen? Where does it come from? Mm-hmm. And is it related to the Earl Warren book?
It is. And first, before I answer that, let me just say, first of all, thank you to all of you for being here, but especially thank you to you, Scott. I am an unabashed admirer of this man's work, and it is a really special treat for me to be on the stage with you tonight.
Thank you.
Well, it starts with Warren. I was made an editor at the Los Angeles Times, and I was put in charge of our Sacramento political and government coverage in 2000 or 2001, somewhere back in there. In the course of trying to get up to speed to do that job, I was searching for books about California governors and California government, and discovered at first, sort of to my surprise and sort of dismay, that there really wasn't a great book, or what I didn't feel was a great book about Warren, particularly that unified his gubernatorial years with his chief justiceship. He was, until very recently, the only three-term governor in the history of California. So he had a formidable California life before his Washington life. So I set off to do some research on that and ultimately concluded that there was a book worth writing on it, and then took some time off from the Times to complete that book. Returned, and then an editor who both Scott and I work with closely, Phyllis Grand in New York, had read the Warren book and was convinced there was an important book to do on the Eisenhower presidency, so she really brought the idea of following up with Ike to me.
And then you say, yes, there is, there isn't, aren't there other books on Eisenhower? Did you ask yourself, what am I going to bring to this party? And in essence, I think what I'm asking is, I think each of us who writes a book signs a contract with the reader, in essence. What did you think you were going to deliver to the reader, and why Eisenhower?
Well, I felt, partly at Phyllis's urging, but more and more as I got further into the kind of preliminary research, there's a huge amount that's been written about Eisenhower in the war, and some of it is quite good. It was Phyllis's observation, and again, I came to agree, that the presidential years were not well covered, that really the only significant book on the presidency was the second part of Stephen Ambrose's two-part biography, two-volume biography of Eisenhower. It turns out to have some real problems, frankly, although I discovered those somewhat later. But there was, I thought, a real dearth of significant research on the presidential years. There were documents that had become declassified in the interim and more that came declassified in the course of my work. So I think there was a largely untold story of the presidency. And as one result of that, it was a largely unappreciated presidency in some of the ways that Louise just described a minute ago. So I'll add just one more fact that was sort of a surprise to me. Because I had seen Warren I had seen Eisenhower mostly through Warren's eyes because of the previous research, I believed that I was setting out to write a much more critical biography of Eisenhower than I ultimately did. Warren and Eisenhower did not particularly like each other as years went by. They had some falling outs, which we can talk about later. When I saw Eisenhower through the prism of the Supreme Court, and particularly through Warren, I believed I would end up writing a much more sharply critical book. Instead, as I became much more familiar, particularly with his record in foreign affairs and diplomatic relations, I really became convinced that it was a much more successful presidency than I had given him credit for, along with others. And so the book ends up being more favorable than the one I thought I would write.
And so in what ways do you think this book is, and part of the answer is I know it concentrates so much on the White House years. In what ways do you feel it differs from other things that have been written about Eisenhower? And were you consciously trying to go in that direction? Or did you just say, I'm going to let this book write itself? I'll let Eisenhower dictate the book.
I think more the latter than the former. I mean, I think I tried to write the story as it as I perceived it, without trying to position it between other takes on Eisenhower. The result, though, is I do think it is a different take in some important regards. I think that it is the most important work that's been done on Eisenhower has mostly been in the realm of the presidency, has mostly been in the realm of political science. Fred Greenstein's very important Hidden Hand Presidency is really the first book that began to examine Eisenhower as a more positive president than historians of the day were giving him credit for. And that's because Greenstein really explored Eisenhower's style of leadership in a way that others hadn't. I think the trend since then has been more positive. The trend up to then had been more negative. And then I think there are just other pieces of the book that are that are fresh. And part of that is that, particularly in the area of nuclear weapons and diplomatic relations, there's been a very slow process of declassification. The process now for declassifying documents that are still in the Eisenhower collection is that it is only done on the by request. So there is no routine review of these documents. If there's a document you find that's classified, you can make a request to the agency, and the relevant agency will review it, and 18 months later, you get an answer. So it's a very slow process. Some of that has continued to come out, and I think that therefore the picture is bigger and richer. And not altogether, I don't want to paint too rosy a picture of the administration. I think in some respects the record has gotten worse, or more negative, particularly in the area of covert action in Iran and Guatemala and other places. As we've learned more about those, I think there we see the long-term ramifications of the Eisenhower moves are much more negative than we would have perceived at the time. So I think the record has filled out in ways that are both beneficial to Ike and that tend to denigrate his presidency.
Yeah, and I hope we can talk about some of those, but while we're here at the beginning, I'd like to do a little mm-hmm. more methodology, if that's possible, mm-hmm. too. So how did you do this? Do you have researchers? Do you do it alone? I see, in your acknowledgments, you went off to Abilene and you go to various libraries and so forth. Obviously, the newspaper was very generous with you.
It was.
But you go off and what do? Do you take notes by hand? Do you what's?
Yeah, I'm the last person at the Eisenhower Library using the Xerox machine, I'm afraid. I can't tell you how many copies we remodeled our garage to hold the Xerox copies that I have from these two books. I did not work with a researcher. I would love to be able to work with a researcher, but I've frankly, and I don't know your experience, but I've had difficulty figuring out how to ask someone else to look for what catches my eye in material. And since so much of what I do, my routine over the last few years has been every 10 weeks or so to head to the Eisenhower Library in Abilene to rent my room at the Holiday Inn. And I'm here to tell you that there's not much to do in Abilene between the closure of the library at the evening and the opening the next day. So I go, I make copies, I read material, I see what is interesting. And then I take, they'll allow you to take the oral history transcripts home. So I take those home in the evening and read those. It's a fairly grueling research experience. But over time, what emerged is a real stack of material and real gems within it. And yes, you're absolutely right. The paper was very generous to allow me the opportunity to do that in both books. Each required a leave of absence of a period from the paper, but also some generous colleagues.
And how long was this book from start to finish for you?
The two books together, about 10 years.
I see.
But this one, a little less than half of that. Warren, a little more than half of that. But if I hadn't done Warren first,
sure.
This one would have taken longer
sure.
because
You've
of
done
the overlapping
a lot of spade
history.
Work already.
Yeah. So I would say independently, they're probably at least 5-year projects each, maybe a little longer. As a combo, I saved a little time as a result.
And while you're doing your heavy-duty newspaper work, are you still working on Ike every day or every week, or do you do it in chunks when
no,
time
I,
permits?
No, I've worked on Ike pretty much every day of those 5 years, I'm happy to say, or unhappy to say. It really, there came a point in each book, and in this one certainly, where I couldn't do the newspaper work at the same time. The newspaper work that I do now is mostly writing a column. In the period, though, when I was doing most of this book, I was editor of the editorial pages. And it just required my presence physically there just to handle personnel issues and to read editorials and to lay the page. One of the things, I won't bore you with the mechanics of the editorial pages, but you'll notice it's the only pages in the paper where no story jumps from one page to another. So everything has to fit to the line. And that requires presence in a way that is not really possible in this. So there came a time where I stepped aside for a year and a half to do the final work on it.
Right. Well, let's talk about Eisenhower himself a little, especially because this book does concentrate on the White House years. But I'm wondering, obviously you give us his prehistory before the White House. What did you find, or what were you thinking, came from Eisenhower's childhood that informed you and the rest of his life, his presidency in particular? In other words, what are those themes, what are the seeds you were looking to plant at the beginning of this mm-hmm. book that were going to flower right. in the presidency.
Well, just to return to methodology for one more second on this, that's the opening chapters of this book are the pieces that I reworked the most extensively and under the guidance of Phyllis, our editor. I had initially written that section of the book as basically two very long chapters that took you from childhood through the end of the Second World War and into the beginnings of his political career. And it was Phyllis's observation that the problem with that is it required such shortening, particularly of dramatic episodes in the war, that her fear was that it would feel like I didn't really understand the war material, that it was clipped back too hard. So she's the one who suggested revisiting that and told as the characters who made the greatest impression on him, rather than a straight chronology of his life up to the presidency. And I think it was an extraordinarily helpful suggestion.
Very effective.
Because, among other things, it isolated just what you're asking about, which is what are the things that mattered to him. I think it mattered a lot that he grew up, he was one of six brothers. He grew up in a house smaller than his office when he was chief of staff of the United States Army. It mattered not only that he was sort of in the middle of those brothers, but that he had brothers who were much more conservative than he and brothers who were much more liberal than he. Milton, his youngest brother, was an esteemed academic, president of Johns Hopkins, and a close advisor of Ike. One of his older brothers, Edgar, very conservative. This is a president, and this is probably a little bit glib to observe, but this is a president who crafted his politics on the pursuit of the middle way. He grew up smack in the middle of a very divisive, or very, not divisive, it was actually a very close family, but a very, diverse family. As he grew older, I think one of the things you really see in Ike's young life is an almost stunning incapacity for dealing with women. He grew up with all brothers. He and Mamie had a sort of tempestuous relationship early in their marriage. He went to West Point. He really had just no experience in the life of women. So I think that Mamie is sort of an important introducer to that whole part of the world for him. So that's one of the ways in which she's formed the marriage. She was quite young. She was still a teenager when they were married. And then as you move through his war life, he was exceptionally able to attract mentors to himself. He was spotted between the wars. Fox Connor is a very important and somewhat unheralded general in the United States military between the wars, a really capable talent scout of potential generals. He saw great promise in Ike and brought him for a sort of tutorial. They served together in Panama for several years and really taught Ike military history, brought Ike in as a very young, not very promising student, sent him off to the command college at Fort Leavenworth, where he graduated number one in his mm-hmm. class. A really important transformative moment for him. Two real negative examples from his growing up, which he also was quite good at extracting the things he didn't want to be from people. He was quite good friends with General Patton, but recognized that Patton had a kind of flamboyance that he didn't want to emulate as a military leader. And that was most acutely observed in his relationship with Douglas MacArthur. Douglas MacArthur, Ike used to refer to his time with Douglas MacArthur as a study in theatrics. And as I was telling someone just before we came in here today, MacArthur used to say that Ike was the best clerk I ever had. So he understood. And then finally, I guess the last two, all just to complete the story, the general who he most admired, in some ways the person he most admired, General George Marshall, who identified Ike for command of the European theater and delegated to him great responsibility for that theater. Really, I think Eisenhower's style of leadership and management as president is in many ways directly an attempt to emulate what he learned from Marshall. And then finally, the last character in that section of the book is Herbert Brownell, who introduced Eisenhower to politics, became his attorney general, and to the extent that Eisenhower was able to compile a successful record in civil rights, for instance, it was really because he followed Marshall's advice and delegated authority, and in this case delegated it to Herb Brownell, who compiled a quite successful record for the administration.
How smart do you think Eisenhower was, and was he literary at all? Did he know things beyond military history? Did he have a sense of history, in fact? And if so, whom did he take an interest in?
Yes, I think he had a great sense in history, and particularly military history, and therefore a shrewd observer of leaders and effective leadership versus ineffective leadership. That said, no, in a literary sense, he was not well read in fiction and in literature. You know, he's famous as president for reading Westerns. And there is, part of that, I think he's a person who needed to relax and did, whether it was playing bridge or fishing or reading Westerns. So he understood kind of his own disposition and temperament. But to the extent that he had a broader, bigger mind, he was a quite eloquent writer, interestingly, which I think contrasts with our sense of him mostly derived from his extemporaneous remarks, which could be quite clunky. His formal speech, very much in that West Point tradition, was very studied, very articulate, very precise. He wrote great directions, great orders, a clear writer. So in all those senses, I think a much smarter person than he was given credit for at the time, when the predominant view of him was that he was a good guy and an amiable guy, but that the real brains of the outfit of the administration were John Foster Dulles or Herb Brownell or the various people around, the business people who he surrounded himself with. I think he was thought of as a kind of good-natured but not particularly bright. In fact, Susan Eisenhower, his granddaughter, who I saw in Washington recently, made the point. She said, you know, all these people thought he was so brilliant during the war, and then he thought he was so dumb as president. You must wonder what happened to him. So I think he was profoundly underestimated in those ways.
Yes, yes. Yeah, and you raised another a point that I wanted to ask you about when you mentioned Susan Eisenhower. Were there people for you to talk to about Eisenhower? Were there firsthand witnesses? Or were they there and you didn't want to talk to people, which is often the case, too?
Yeah, there are not many. And this is in contrast to the Warren experience, where because Warren, he ended his career, obviously, as Chief Justice, and in all those years he was in his 60s and 70s, and he had people working for him who were in their 20s. So they're around to talk to. There are no living members of the Eisenhower cabinet, for instance. And Eisenhower was born in 1890, so that's no great surprise. A couple people were very helpful. West Point historian Clint Anker, who really helped me very much with the military history, not because he understood Ike, but because he was able to fill out a part of my knowledge that I didn't have. But then the person who knew Eisenhower best and who was most helpful to me was his son, John. John was extremely reluctant to talk to me. In fact, it took him several years to agree to talk to me. When he finally did, he said, you know, I've been talking about this man for 68 years. And I said, well, what would be the harm of one more? He is not only a very good writer and a very shrewd observer, but I think he's a really uncommonly shrewd observer of a father. I had the experience, for instance, in writing about Warren, I talked to all the living children, and they were very helpful, and they were very helpful and supportive of me. But many times, they didn't quite grasp what I was looking for, in the sense that one of Earl Warren's sons, Earl Warren Jr., is a judge. And he was very interested in talking about his views of Brown versus Board of Education, which I admire, and he has every right to. But there are a lot of people in the world who have views about Brown versus Board of Education. I wanted to know whether he drank bourbon or rye. And John, I think, understood that as a writer himself, understood that there were observations and insights that I was looking for from him, and he was really generous about supplying them.
He clearly was generous. And why do you think he spoke to you? I mean, after 68 years of talking about his father, what do you think you did that?
Well, I may have annoyed him into it. I certainly did ask him a lot. I did try to explain to him what I was trying to set out to do. So I don't. I mean, I think that he had a sense that I was. I wasn't trying to trick him into anything. I wasn't. I think. Many people, I think, have approached him over the years with a desire to get at some, something that's been sort of swept under the rug or is a missing. That really wasn't my objective. I really was there to try to understand his father better.
Yeah.
And I think that, I guess I should let him speak to that, but that would be my impression, if anything, that might have been what tipped the scales on it.
Now to go back to something you started to talk about, which I wanted to pursue just another beat anyway, is this question of leadership. At what point do you think Dwight Eisenhower had a sense that he was a leader? It's another one of those seeds that grows into something big, because he was in World War II, wasn't he?
World War I. Yes, both. I think it is
a job in World War II.
Big job in the second one. I think it starts to turn when he went to spend the time in Panama with Fox Connor. When Connor, who was an acknowledged genius for identifying potential talent in the United States military identified him. I think he knew that he was someone special. His experience at West Point was entirely unremarkable. He was known, he's best known as what they call a sentry man, and that refers to someone who has been disciplined so often that he's had to march at least 100 hours in the yard. So he was not turning a lot of heads at West Point. Yeah. He did, as I mentioned briefly earlier, spend time with Patton, and I think saw some potential in him, saw that Patton admired him and saw potential in him. So I think there was some glimmer of it there. But really, when he went to Panama, the routine that he had with Fox Connor is that Fox Connor had an extensive library of military history, and he made him read it. And he would send him off to read, one military history after another, and then quiz him on it. And really began, I think, to expand Eisenhower from a sort of perfunctory military man into a really deeply thinking one. And then I think when he graduated first at Leavenworth, that marked him as someone special in the military. And it's no coincidence, I think it's about that time he begins to keep a diary, which he kept it very sporadically throughout his life. But I think it's hard not to see that act of beginning to write down his thoughts as also beginning to recognize that his thoughts were worth saving. And he kept it fairly regularly during his time with MacArthur and very archly observed MacArthur. Again, I think once you see him critiquing his boss in MacArthur, there's a sense that he's rising up into his own. And really, then immediately after Pearl Harbor, General Marshall used to keep a black book in which he wrote the names of potential generals, and he had Ike in his book. And he asked Mark Clark, who had been a classmate of Ike's, for his recommendations of 10 generals he should bring to Washington. And Mark Clark said famously, Eisenhower and 10 dittos, or 9 dittos, I guess it would be. And that endorsement and that launching, then from that point on, there's no question but that he recognized himself as a person of greatness.
And now to make the real leap, which is what your book is about, at what point does he say, I could be president of the United States, or did somebody else say, he should be president of the United States? And what is the thought process? What is the interchange that goes on?
Well, the first instance is others saying to him, you should be president. In fact, very famously, Harry Truman said to him in 48, or in advance of the 48 election, that if Eisenhower would agree to run for president, that Truman would step down and run as his vice president. This is Truman mistakenly under the impression that Ike was a Democrat, and he was not. And that's an awfully strange proposal from a sitting American president, as you all would appreciate. From that, Ike doesn't decide to run, obviously, in 48, and sort of takes himself out of it. He goes on to serve as the head of NATO. And then it's in the second iteration, in 52, I think it's the combination of others urging him to run and his deep dissatisfaction with the rest of the field. Truman had fired MacArthur in Korea, and MacArthur was contemplating a run, an idea that simply horrified Eisenhower. Eisenhower had attempted to coax Taft into a more internationalist perspective, and in fact was prepared not to run if Taft would modulate his isolationism. Taft rebuffed him. The idea of Taft being the nominee similarly then troubled him. And he was quite frankly fed up with Truman, principally in the lead up to the Korean War and what he felt was the mishandling of that. So I think while it is partly his own, his own ego and his own sense of stature and his sense that he was capable, that he was a capable commander and that he could lead. But I also think he thought the alternatives, that he owed it to the country. There was a sense of duty to head off the alternatives.
And how political was he? You can answer that in a lot of ways, I think. But in 52, here's somebody who hasn't run for an office before and now is running for the office. Why don't you talk a little about that 52 campaign? Mm-hmm. I'm interested in two personalities, especially beyond Eisenhower's. One would be Adlai Stevenson, against whom he ran, and the second would be the first big choice you make, which is your running mate. I'd like to hear a little about the Nixon-Eisenhower relationship and a little about what he thought of Adlai Stevenson.
It's interesting. He admired Stevenson more in 52 than he did in 56. Of course, he ran against him twice and beat him twice. The second time, less of a close call. It was sort of preordained. But he admired what he saw in Stevenson initially, thought he was quite eloquent. Indeed, it's one of, when he was watching the Democratic convention on TV in 52, one of his friends turned to him and said, or he turned to one of his friends and said, "This is a very eloquent speaker. We're going to have trouble with him." And he said, "No, he's too eloquent." Mm-hmm. And I think that Eisenhower got that. He did have a common touch that was unlike really anyone of his period. And while you're absolutely right, of course, that he'd never run for office before, I think it's easy to underestimate the amount of political experience that the war gave him. That his management, his role in the war was not as a tactical general. It was the management of Montgomery and Patton and the relationship with Churchill, the relationship with de Gaulle. Those are not easy people to get along with. And he, especially communications being what they were, it was really his job to run that alliance in Europe, the American piece of that alliance. So he was a political figure for all intents and purposes during the war. Once he starts to run, he was quite sure-footed and capable, I think, in matters of foreign affairs and certainly military affairs, much less so on the domestic side, and mm-hmm. much more inclined to defer to his advisors, and quite deferential even when it came to the selection of his vice president. Didn't know Nixon well. The chief benefits or attributes that Nixon brought to the vice presidency were that he was young, that he was from California, which they needed to carry, and that he had a record of fierce anti-communism to contrast with Eisenhower's more moderate politics. So all of that made him a good political selection. Soon after he was picked, the so-called slush fund crisis erupted, and there was a very serious move to dump Nixon from the ticket, which Ike entertained. Ike dangled Nixon in a way that really tortured Nixon during that period. He refused to come to his defense for several days. Ultimately, of course, Nixon only salvaged his place on the ticket by giving the famous Checker speech here in Los Angeles and saying that he wouldn't give the Cocker Spaniel back to the donor. The Cocker Spaniel had given it to the donor had given it to his daughters. And that sort of maudlin speech rescues Nixon in the eyes of the public. But most tellingly, I think, of that entire episode is Ike's remark to Nixon when he greets him in Wheeling, West Virginia. He boards Nixon's plane, and Nixon was surprised that Eisenhower was there. And he looks up and he says, "Oh, General," and sort of startled. And he says, "You're here." And he says, "Of course I'm here. You're my boy." And that remark, that sense of paternalism, support, undermined to some extent, or at least complicated by paternalism, was there throughout their relationship. Eisenhower had great respect for Nixon, appreciation for his loyalty and his intelligence, but he never came to see him as an equal. And I think that's a fundamental fact, an unchanging fact of their very otherwise very complicated relationship.
Yeah. This seems like a segue in a way to me, too, to talk a little about, I think, one of the things a lot of people criticize Eisenhower for, and I'm now going to talk about Senator McCarthy. Mm-hmm. Did Eisenhower really take stands? Did he not just sit back, see how things played out, laissez-faire, let people solve the problem, and then I'll sort of come in and sew it up? What went on in Eisenhower's mind during the McCarthy era when he was clearly ruining lives, reputations, maybe America? Did he step up enough? Did he not step up enough? How do you feel now that you've written about Eisenhower? What did Eisenhower think he was doing?
It is, I think, fairly, in its period, was one of the things he was most sharply criticized from his left about, no question. Mm-hmm. And I hope one thing that the book shows is that he was far more active in cutting off McCarthy from McCarthy's mm-hmm. sources of support than was knowable or visible at the time. It is a sort of classic manifestation of the hidden hand presidency, that he is meeting with members of Congress, with newspaper publishers, with business executives, and in all of those meetings expressing his contempt and disgust for McCarthy. It is interesting that throughout the period, there are repeated calls for him to engage McCarthy more directly, and no one ever thinks that if he engages him more directly, it will be to be supportive of him. And so there is an mm-hmm. assumption, there's a known but unstated fact out there that he is unhappy with McCarthy, and partly that's because of all this behind-the-scenes work that he was doing. Now, did he wait too long? Did he not act forcefully enough? I think it's fair to criticize him for that. It's hard to, but it is also hard to wonder or hard to know what would have happened if he had engaged more forcefully. His great fear was that it would elevate McCarthy's stature to have to be in a toe-to-toe battle with the President of the United States. He was also, on a more self-interested level, nervous about the right wing of his own party, which was never firmly under Eisenhower's control and which was much more sympathetic to McCarthy, at least in the early period. When the rubber really met the road, it is Eisenhower who invoked executive privilege and ordered his subordinates not to testify at the McCarthy hearings about their consultations with him. That's a power that Eisenhower arguably did not have. He's the first president ever to invoke executive privilege. Second was Nixon. Interestingly, when Ike invoked executive privilege, it was greatly cheered by American liberals. When Nixon did it, it was greatly condemned. So history cuts both ways. And when that happened, that signaled the definitive beginning of the end of McCarthy. That's in the middle of 1954, and by the end of 54, McCarthy is a spent phenomenon in American life. So it took a long time for the collapse to happen, and many people were damaged in the interim. When it happened, it did happen decisively, and it was over.
Mm-hmm. Now to leap, and again, I think this dovetails to the second great area in which I think Eisenhower is criticized is in the area of civil rights.
Right.
And at the end of the day, it may be the most important thing that happens in the White House years of the Eisenhower years, namely Brown versus Board of Education and Earl Warren and so forth. And yet, was Eisenhower again? Was he just sort of pulled back? Was he detached? Was he waiting for others to fix things? And how did he feel about Brown versus Board of Ed? How did he feel about Earl Warren as a result of all that? And what did he do?
Well, the answer to that is the sum of both books. So,
yes.
So it may be hard to answer
quickly.
That's
why you have to read both these books.
That's right. I think in the area of civil rights, I think Eisenhower's instincts were not good, or not what we would today certainly call good. He grew up in segregated Kansas. He grew up in a segregated military. He had never, to the moment he became president, worked with a black man, much less a black woman, as a peer or again, much less as a supervisor. He did not have a well-tuned set of personal instincts for civil rights, or for the urgency of civil rights. Mm-hmm. That said, I think, oddly, his record on civil rights ends up being considerably better than his background or his instincts. He did appoint Earl Warren Chief Justice on the advice of Herb Brownell. Warren is the first of five justices that Eisenhower put on the court, four of whom I think rank with some of the better justices in American history. The fifth, Whitaker, a nervous breakdown, didn't finish, so he's in another place. But I think four of the five are very credible justices. One of them is also William Brennan, perhaps the most liberal justice of the 20th century. And was a Democrat, by the way, when I put him on the court, and was his whole life. So I think his appointments were very capable. He also appointed great judges to the district courts and appellate benches in the South, who once Brown versus Board, in what's called Brown 2, ordered desegregation infamously to proceed with all deliberate speed, it fell to district and appellate court judges to decide whether individual school districts were in fact fulfilling Brown. It's many of the Eisenhower judges who really carried the load on that. The Eisenhower administration also won passage of the 1957 Civil Rights Act, which, while sort of a pale comparison to the Civil Rights Act of the 1960s, is vitally important because it was the first since Reconstruction. So it really began the work of civil rights through the Congress. And then finally, and probably most memorably for people who lived through the period, in 1957, when Orville Faubus defied integration at Little Rock High School, Eisenhower called in the 101st Airborne, the same division that he asked to soften the beaches at Normandy, to escort nine black children into school. It is pretty much goes without saying that no governor tried to test him that way again. Now, all of that, those are all the facts of the administration's record, and I think they're quite positive. At no point, though, did Ike act out of a genuine conviction that civil rights were an imminent, urgent need of this country. He, in the case of Little Rock, what motivated Eisenhower there was not so much the imperative that those nine children be allowed to attend school, but rather that a governor was not going to command a National Guard in defiance of Eisenhower. There's a great moment where Eisenhower and Faubus sit down together in Newport, Rhode Island, where Eisenhower was vacationing, to try to talk about the issue. And the conversation begins with Faubus describing his service under General Patton in the war, and Ike then responds by describing his service over General Patton in the war. So there was a sense of the power relationship. He was not going to lose that battle. And that's important. It's important that the record ends up being, I think, quite successful. But I also think it's not fair to infer from that record that he had the right disposition or instincts when it came to tackling the issue. Brownell did, and he allowed Brownell great latitude to carry it out.
And Earl Warren, he considered a great mistake, did he not?
He did. There, though, interestingly, I think there's been much misunderstanding about this over the years. The assumption is because Brown is considered the great work of the Warren Court and Ike became very disenchanted with Warren, the assumption is that he's disenchanted about Brown. In fact, the real disenchantment that Eisenhower had with the Warren Court was over its handling of the so-called communist cases. These are the cases in which communists appealed their criminal convictions of, under one act or another to the Supreme Court, arguing that they had a First Amendment right of association that protected their membership in what was, after all, a legal party, even though a sort of a maligned party. The Warren Court overturned many of those criminal convictions, and Eisenhower was furious about it. Eisenhower, in retirement, Warren asked Eisenhower, what would you have done with these communists? And Eisenhower's response was, I would have killed the SOBs. And Warren, in his memoir, said he regarded the remark as merely petulant rather than definitive. So, yes, they did come to see the world differently. I think Warren ended up being a more liberal justice than Ike expected that he would be. And Ike had his disappointment. And Ike also expressed his disappointment in Brennan. There, he had much less reason to be disappointed. Brennan was a liberal going in, a liberal coming out. Yeah. So why he thought Brennan would be anything other than he was is more of a mystery. But in the end, although Ike had reservations about what Brown forced him to do as president and the position that it put him in, he never disavowed the fundamental finding of Brown. And and his animus or his disagreements with Warren really were mostly in other areas.
Clock disappearing on us. I wanted to just get a few personal things of Ike's personal life. One forgets, and I think it's one of the nice parts of the book are the personal threads you've got going through here. But if you talk a little more about Mamie Eisenhower, who many assumed was drunk for many years, and second, there was a child that people tend to forget.
Yeah.
One we remember, but one we forget.
Right. Mamie was not a drunk, interestingly, although widely rumored to be at the time. She suffered from an inner ear affliction, which caused her to stumble on occasion, and people inferred from that that she was a drunk.
I'm going to use that.
Yeah. Right. I suffer from it, too. And yet, they had, as I mentioned, a sort of tempestuous beginning to their marriage. Mamie grew up in relatively well-to-do and then plunged into the pretty austere life of a young Army officer. Didn't always like it. Their marriage struggled on a couple of occasions. They had a young boy they nicknamed Icky, who died at age 4. And it was a tragedy that neither of them really ever got over, as you might expect. They're buried together with Icky in Abilene today. And Eisenhower would often ruminate on the loss of Icky. It was quite crushing to him. Most famously, of course, is the question of whether Eisenhower had an affair with his driver during the war, Kay Summersby. I don't know the answer to it. There's a book that's come out just a few weeks ago on Eisenhower that deals more heavily with the war years, where the author comes to the conclusion that there was an affair. I don't know. I think there's really no way to prove it one way or another. Kay wrote two memoirs, one in which she said they had an affair, one in which she said they didn't, which doesn't help matters much. Here, you know, John, among the many riddles that John Eisenhower helped me solve was to say, he said, I knew them. They had a dog together. They played cards together. She was his driver. They clearly spent a lot of time together. He said, I can't tell you whether they had a physical relationship. He said, I can tell you that they had a rapport. And they did. And he said, and he heartily approved of it. Mamie did not. It clearly hurt her feelings. Whatever the relationship was, it didn't outlast the war. The Eisenhower marriage resumed, and they lived it to the ends of his life. So it was a, by I think any stretch of the imagination, a successful marriage, but not without its difficulties.
Mm-hmm. Will you do another book? Would you like to do another book? If so, do you know what it will be? Are you waiting for a phone call to say?
Well, if you know someone who's got a phone call to make, just send them my way. Okay. I would like to do another book, and I'm quite hopeful that I will. I've been talking to Phyllis about it a little bit. I don't exactly have a subject yet, and for the moment, as we mentioned a couple times here, the paper's been quite generous to me over the years, and I do feel I owe some time and attention there. And so eventually I hope there'll be another book. But for the moment, I'm concentrating on the column and the paper.
Yes, yes. In another era, I would have asked boxers or briefs, but now I think the question is Kindle, or do you ever read books on Kindles?
I do. We're traveling especially. Mm-hmm. I still am pretty wedded to the actual physical object of it, but I've taken to the Kindle some. So
yeah, that's
we
good.
Were you know, my wife and I were traveling in Mexico recently, and there's nothing quite like the experience of reading something being taken. I was reading a novel and realized I had never read Goethe, and so I hit a button, and 30 seconds later I had
there
it.
Was.
There
is
there is something there he said for was. It.
And for you, what should be the takeaway for us as readers of Eisenhower? Why does Eisenhower speak to us? I mean, here it's 50 years later. Why should he be speaking to us? Why should we be paying attention to Dwight Eisenhower today? What does he have to tell us?
I will say in two areas he's worth our reflection, if not entirely emulation, at least reflection.
Yeah,
he. Came to the presidency in the middle of a recession, fought repeated attempts within his own party to lower federal income taxes. The federal income tax rate when the top marginal rate when Eisenhower became president and when he left the presidency was 91%. That's the taxes charged on income of $400,000 or more. Needless to say, that is not on the table in Washington today. But it is also worth remembering the American economy nearly doubled in output with those tax rates, that he inherited a $8 to $10 billion deficit and left a $500 million surplus. He's the last president until Bill Clinton to leave the United States with a surplus. I think it's worth considering that economic record as we debate whether the top rate should be 39.6% or 35%, which is the debate today. The second, and in some ways more salient and more important point, I think, he came to the presidency with the nation at war, in the middle of the Korean War. Within 7 months, he'd ended the Korean War, as he promised to do. And in the period from the end of the Korean War to the end of his presidency, this nation dealt with the Chinese at Dien Bien Phu, Chinese shelled Taiwan repeatedly, a close American ally, Soviets cut off access to Berlin. Castro came to power in Cuba. I'm not doing these in chronological order, but yeah. The British and French and Israelis attacked Egypt over the Suez Canal. The Soviet Union crushed an uprising in Hungary. Khrushchev threatened to cut off access to West Berlin. Time and time again, Ike's advisors advised him to wage a military response in those episodes, and they often urged him to use a nuclear response in those episodes. During that period, the entire number of American soldiers killed in combat was a single American Marine shot by a sniper in Lebanon in 1957 or 58. That is a record of peacekeeping that I think is worthy of our serious consideration today.
Yeah, yeah. Now, we have a few minutes for questions from any of you. Yeah, well, I'm told the microphones will come to you. So, all right.
Thank you both very much. It was a very, very interesting discussion. But my question is, how do you reconcile your view that Eisenhower took the middle way in view of the fact he refused to address the hideous racial discrimination in the country during the 50s? There were still lynchings in the South and other horrible things going on throughout parts of the country, as well as his support of the military dictatorships in South America, and particularly in Guatemala with the CIA's supposed assassination of our bends and in Chile. And how does that fit with your view of the middle way?
It's a good question. And we talked a little bit about civil rights already, where I guess my argument would be that his record kind of exceeded where his natural impulses on it. So let me instead focus on the covert action stuff, which I think is the biggest blight on the Eisenhower foreign policy record. The administration in its first 18 months or so waged what it regarded as two very successful covert actions, the overthrow of Mossadegh in Iran and the overthrow of Arbenz in Guatemala. I think we can see now, in retrospect, their misapprehension of what they'd done. One thing to remember about Iran is that among those who was in the crowd, so agitated by the American involvement in that crisis was Khomeini. One of those who was on the ground in Guatemala who was offended by the American actions against Arbenz was Che Guevara. So in each instance, we lit a fuse, the United States government, the Eisenhower administration, lit a fuse that would blow up later in ways that would make us see the long-term ramifications of it. At the time, and Eisenhower died believing those both were great successes, they seemed cheap ways to repel to either remove shaky governments or repel Soviet adventurism without the loss of American life, and an alternative to a frontal confrontation with either Soviet or Chinese communism. That doesn't make them right, and I wouldn't defend the administration's record in either Guatemala or Chile or in some of its other. Indonesia was another failed attempt to overthrow a government. But it is, I think, also important to recognize that within the context of the Cold War, at least at the time, within their period, they appeared to be successful, which is why they cried it again and again.
Following along that same line, could you comment on Mossadegh, which was orchestrated by James Roosevelt?
Right, Kermit Roosevelt, right? it was a, again, in its period, regarded as this extraordinarily easy way to solve a very difficult problem. It is, again, I say that not to defend it, but the fact is that Mossadegh was, to the administration, appeared to be a highly unstable leader. There was great concern, not so much that he was a communist, but that his government would fall and that the Soviets would exploit that weakness. And so instead, they pushed him the other way and replaced him. It's a terribly dramatic period. I mean, the whole story of trying to buck up the Shah, and the Shah flees, and they have to bring him back. And I mean, there's a lot of just the manipulation of it is really extraordinary. Again, just to repeat myself, but I think that now we see the long-term damage that that did to American interests in Iran and throughout the Muslim world. At the time, the agitating the Muslim world was not the concern. The concern was containing the Soviet communism. And as I say, what succeeded in one sphere clearly failed at another.
Eisenhower famously left us with a caution about an emergence of a military-industrial complex. How do you account for that, given his military background?
The most fun piece of research for me on this book occurred in the context of the speech. The final chapter of the book is built largely around the speech. I was at the Eisenhower Library one day when the deputy director, Tim Reeves, tapped me on the shoulder in the reading room and said, "We've got something I think you're going to be interested in." And we came out and he showed me that they were loading six boxes of material in the loading dock of the library. And it turned out what had happened, at the end of the administration, most of the members of the administration donated their papers to the library, and they're there today, obviously. For reasons that are still unclear, Malcolm Moose, who was the principal author of the speech, took several boxes home with him and put them in a warehouse, in a storage facility in Minnesota, where he went on to live. And his family forgot about him. They, at one point, they were closing up the storage facility. They put him in a boathouse. And a couple summers ago, they were cleaning out the boathouse at the end of the summer, and Moose's sister or Moose's daughter said to his son, "You know, maybe we should see what are in these boxes." And they opened them up, and it's 29 drafts of the speech, the memos that accompanied the speech. So suddenly, you know, 50-odd years after the speech is by far the most analyzed piece of the Eisenhower rhetorical history, suddenly we had a whole new view of what it was. So it's a reminder that historical research is never quite finished. To the substance of your question, though, Eisenhower the phenomenon that he was concerned about in the military-industrial, in warning about the complex, is not so much that this country is will have to defend itself or that it will need a military. He believed in the American military for all the reasons you'd expect. He saw that something had changed from his life as a young military officer to the present, which is that a defense establishment that once could rise up, could be built up in response to a threat, now had become a permanent fact of American life, that we could no longer convert the auto industry into tank construction in order to respond to a threat in Europe, that the whole thing would be over in minutes, and that that gave rise to a new force in American life that had really potentially pernicious effects on our government. As he points out, wanted or the influence of the complex, wanted or unwanted. So he's not even blaming them for grabbing power. It's that they wielded power now. And he was trying to sound a final alarm about it. The other piece of the speech, and I'll just say this briefly, that is largely forgotten, is he also warned of the emergence of what he called the scientific technological elite. And I think partly because it was, he called it an elite, not a complex, it sounded less ominous. But he was equally concerned about that. And his concern there was that that research, that university research and the role of the lone scientist, the entrepreneur, was being so swallowed up by the government's needs, that the government was now the sponsor of so much research, that we were going to lose the variety of innovation that American society had once produced, and it was going to become much more government-driven and much more militarily driven. In some ways, that's even more prescient than the warning about the military-industrial complex, but because that's measured by things that aren't done, it's hard to know exactly what price we've paid for that as a society. But he was quite concerned about that as well. And as I say, that piece of it has, because it didn't find an audience in the way the military-industrial complex did, and because I think it seemed less ominous, it's been much less remarked on over the years.
I think we have time for two more questions.
Yes. You explained to us why Eisenhower resented having nominated Warren to the Supreme Court and, in fact, the Chief Justice. What was the reason, the main reason, that he nominated him?
He it was partly on Brownell's recommendation, but I think what he saw in Warren, he saw a fellow Republican moderate whose chief opposition within the party was Taft, who viewed himself as an internationalist. He saw something of himself. What I think he didn't see is that he didn't see that Warren, he came out of a Midwestern and then later kind of Eastern establishment Republican tradition. Warren came out of a California progressive Republican tradition. And Eisenhower did not fully understand how different those things were. It is not fair. Eisenhower, as with many people, believe that Warren had somehow changed as Chief Justice. That's an inaccurate reading of Warren. Warren was about the Chief Justice that a close inspection of him in 1952 or 53 might have predicted. Instead, I think they sized him up incorrectly and got the Chief Justice that Warren naturally was bound to be, but is not what they expected. Not they, meaning Brownell or Ike.
You talk about his being benefiting from having mentors. For whom was he a mentor? And how did he use television to get his message across after his heart attack and his stroke?
The mentor question is a good one. I don't know that I have a ready answer to it. He certainly was greatly admired within his administration and by many others, but I can't point you to a specific person he mentored. I'll think about that and find me afterward. I'll see if I can give you an answer. On the question of his heart attack, one of the reasons, as I mentioned, he very much admired Nixon's intelligence and his loyalty is he very much appreciated the way Nixon rose to the issue of the heart attack. Nixon, Sherman Adams, and John Foster Dulles essentially divided the administration's duties in that period and carried them out. Eisenhower was out of office for over 3 months. I mean, the president goes to Hawaii these days for 72 hours, and we think the whole world is on edge. And then when he came back, he was significantly debilitated for a long time. Television was an important part of his eventually returning and reassuring the American people that he was healthy again, certainly an important part of his running for president again in 56 and deciding that he was capable of carrying on the presidency. But he was not as vigorous in the second term. The heart attack did hurt him. He also had a severe attack of colitis and a stroke, all within a couple of years as president. And so ultimately, of course, did recover and then had a series of heart attacks in retirement. But he is the first American president to have a heart attack and come back to office. And so that was an extremely difficult period for him. He was also quite old for president in those days, again, superseded by presidents since. But there was real question about whether he would be able to resume the duties of the presidency.
Well, I just wanted to say two things. Well, maybe three. Who knows? But one of them is I think one of the real strengths of this book is there isn't an agenda. And as you just hearing Jim talk tonight, you get a sense he's not trying to convince you of one thing or another about Eisenhower, whether it's on McCarthy or civil rights or whatever. And I think that is really why this book will be around for a long time. The second thing I wanted to tell you all is he's a pretty good talker, but he's a much better writer. And I really urge you to read this book. I thank you all for being here tonight, and I thank you, Jim, for writing the book and for being here.
Thank you, Scott. Thank you so much.
Aloud is made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the National Endowment for the Arts, Errant Fox, City National Bank, KPMG, Donna and Martin J. Wolf, and the Bujaki Foundation. Additional support provided by the Los Angeles Public Library, the Council of the Library Foundation, the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, and individual Library Foundation members. Media support provided by KCRW 89.9 FM, KUSC 91.5 FM, and LA Weekly. The Aloud theme was composed by Larry Karish.